Today on Main Calling, syndicated personal finance columnist Michelle Singletary. Do any of your New Year's resolutions by chance have to do with money? To rein in spending, reassess your retirement plan, improve your credit score? According to a survey by Statista, among people making a resolution this year, number one is to save more money. It even beats eating healthier and exercising more. No surprise, as Americans are carrying a record amount of credit card debt right now. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Main Calling, we have the perfect guest to help us with our personal finance goals for the year, syndicated columnist Michelle Singletary. Her column, The Color of Money, appears in the Washington Post and hundreds of other papers. She'll answer your questions about personal finance next on Main Calling.
Main Calling is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn, and by Maine Health, where care teams provide expert, coordinated care focused on your overall wellness to help you be your healthiest self. MaineHealth.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Main Calling. Holiday shopping, credit card bills are coming due, tax season approaches, and the new year always brings questions about maybe how to save more, handle your finances better. Well, we will discuss those issues and more on today's program with Michelle Singletary, personal finance columnist for the Washington Post, author of four books, including What to Do with Your Money When Crisis Hits, a survival guide. She's in hundreds of papers. We invite you to join the conversation. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Michelle, welcome back to Main Calling and Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year. Thank you for having me.
And I'm going to start with the new year because you had a column recently that I thought was interesting because it was kind of philosophical. And basically what it advised people in this new year is not necessarily one specific thing or another, but rather to maybe have a little reckoning with yourself.
That's right. You know, every year, and I like making New Year's resolutions. I know people like hate it, and there are studies that show by February people have like dropped off, but I love it. I think it gives you a chance to change every year. And even if you didn't succeed with your goals, it's okay because you figured out what didn't work. And this year I wanted to, instead of saying, you know, look at your credit card debt, pay it off, you know, save more money, retirement, all the standard things, I wanted to have people sort of do a deep dive into their soul. Like, what is keeping you from reaching your financial goals? Like, face your financial truth. And oftentimes, my pastor likes to say, people don't have a money problem. Lots of people don't have a money problem. They have a money management problem. And where does that stem from? Oftentimes, the way we were raised, things that happened to us in our childhood, maybe you grew up poor. And then once you got a little bit of money, you're like, I hated wearing hand-me-downs, so I'm going to buy new every single time I can get my hands on money. Or, you know, maybe you grew up in a household where you had a silver spoon, but you don't have your parents' money and you're still trying to live that life. And so I'm just sort of having people to think about, why can't you make good financial decisions? Why are you a miser? Why are you so set on not helping other people? What is that about? And that's sort of start the year off looking at your past and looking at the mistakes and then moving forward with that. And then also your health. Your health is connected to your wealth. Lots of people in their senior years know that very well. Some of the health challenges you have no control over. It's just aging. But some of it is our fault, right? We don't eat well. We don't sleep. And I can just say that. I am like raising my hand. One of my best friends, you know, would look at my life and all the things I've done. And she's like, I just don't know how you do it all. And in my head, I'm thinking, because I don't sleep. And that's not good. And it's going to catch up with me. And it is catching up with me. And then I wanted to end with generosity. You want to have more money? Be more grateful. Because gratefulness is cost effective. Because when you look at what you have, you're not wanting for so much more. And that's a good way to save money.
Yeah, really great advice. And so interesting because some of it, you know, you were talking about were you raised poor and you want to spend a lot of money now. And also you were talking about maybe there are deep-seated reasons for things like trauma. And it's a good time to really address those and think to yourself, instead of beating yourself up for not being able to change your habits, maybe are there root reasons for these habits?
That's right. I'm a big advocate for mental health, seeking mental health. That's quite right. But basically finding someone who can work. Yeah, for treatment. That's right. You know, like looking for a therapist or a counselor who can help you walk through some problems. And for the longest time, you know, people didn't want to do that because it's sort of there's a negative stigma to it. But many healthcare plans, my company has mental health programs and your EAP might, your employee assistance program. So, you know, utilize those. I mean, I've had to in my life. I mean, my parents abandoned me, you know, lots of issues with that. My grandfather was an alcoholic. So, you know, a lot of stuff with that. My grandmother was worried about money all the time. Great money manager, but worried about it all the time. She passed that worry on to me. And I've been trying to, like, deal with that. Like, I'm doing well. My husband's doing well. But why am I worried all the time? And that's not good. So, you know, I had to do a deep dive to try to figure out what's happening and how to, you know, experience more joy so I'm not so worried about money all the time.
Sure. And such wonderful advice. Before we move on, something else that stuck out to me from your column was just basically a lot of people say that they have a hard time saving. They know they need to save more. But a lot of people will say, well, it's just I just don't make enough money and everything's too expensive. And yes, there are people for whom it is very, very difficult. But you say there are also a lot of people for whom it isn't their income. It's something else.
That's right. Yeah. You know, and I'm glad you started off with that because sometimes when you talk about this, people right away, well, there's people who don't make much. And that is absolutely true. You live in a high cost area. Your job doesn't pay enough. There's not a lot of pay raises, that kind of thing. And we're not talking about those folks. But there are a lot of people that I deal with. I have a ministry in my church, a financial ministry, and I meet people with six-figure salaries, husband and wife, and negative net worth. And what is that about? And, you know, they're overspending, and they'll swear, oh, we just don't have any money in our budget. And then my husband and I, or one of our people in the program, will sit down with folks and go through their, you know, bank statements and credit card debt. And it's like, what in the world? One couple spent $1,500 on eating out in like a 2 month period. And then they're like, we don't have money to put in the kids' college fund. I'm thinking, well, you need to stop going to Chick-fil-A. You know? I mean, not that I not like Chick-fil-A, but the point is that they just, you know, there's so much unconscious spending. There's so much denial. People lie to themselves. They, you know, there's nothing in my budget. There's no room. And there is room. You're making decisions that end up not having room. And so, you know, we get, you know, truth telling, right? You got to be truthful to yourself that you probably, and some people listening might have that money that they think they don't have, but you're making decisions that are so unconscious that you don't even see that you do have the money to save for retirement. You do have the money to put aside for your kids' college education or an emergency fund.
All right. Well, we are talking with Michelle Singletary. We're going to go to break a little bit early. So many things I want to talk to you about, Michelle. The record credit card debt for Americans, the big series that you've been working on about scams, and then maybe just some things about what we might want to think about this year very practically. But we're going to take a break first. If you'd like to ask Michelle Singletary a question, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today, answers to our questions about money matters. Michelle Singletary is our guest. She's a syndicated personal finance columnist for The Washington Post and the author of 4 books on personal finance. We invite you to join the conversation. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Michelle, before the holidays, before people spent money, I read an article that said that Americans are carrying record credit card debt. And this is before people did holiday spending. Right now, I'm looking at a CNBC article. Nearly half of credit card users are carrying debt. And I'm wondering if you could say something to people who are in this position, who all of a sudden say, how did this happen? How do I have this credit card debt? What do I do now? What's your advice?
Yeah. And you said this before earlier, Jen. First of all, don't beat yourself up. I'm not going to beat you up. I'm not going to judge you. You know, life happens. You make bad decisions, or perhaps you lost a job and you turned to credit cards to bridge that gap between your income, or you're overspending. You know that. There's no point in beating yourself up, but you do need to have a plan. And it concerns me that, half of consumers are revolving debt, meaning that every month they don't pay that bill off. And the outstanding credit card debt crossed that $1 trillion mark, right? And so that concerns me, because if there is a disruption in your income or something happens in your family, that debt is so heavy, and it's very expensive debt, on average about 20%. And so that robs you of your ability to have a cushion, to have that money that you could put in your retirement fund if you are servicing debt every month. And I see this in people's budgets. I do something called a debt dash, where we help people figure out how to pay down their debt. And I use the method of starting with the debt with the smallest balance. Some people use the highest interest rate, but in my program, we use smallest balance. And then we have them do a sheet and list all their debts. And when I look at that total month of how much they're servicing debt, $400, $500, $600, $700, over $1,000 every month servicing that credit card debt with that 20% interest. Now you can see why so many people have problems with the other goals that they have in their life, if you got that much money going out of your budget every month. And so it goes back to that truth telling. Okay, what happened? Was it a one-time thing, or is it a reoccurring problem that you just overspending, your lifestyle creeps in some cases, where every time you make more money, you start to spend more. And then you supplement that by using credit. And so get a handle of it. One of the things I ask people, and it kills them, they hate it, it's like, how much debt you have? How much credit card debt? And they don't even want to say the number. If you can't say the number, that's a problem, because you don't want to face it.
Mm. You've been working on a series I know is important to you, looking at people who have been scammed. The Federal Trade Commission estimates 2.6 million people were scammed last year. You think the number's much higher?
Yeah, and the authorities know it's much higher. When they look at people who report it, it's very low. The Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, they crashed one scam operation and found that only about 20% of the victims had reported that they had been scammed. And we're talking millions of dollars. And so I get it. And so this series is a little different than what a lot of people might have read, because a lot of the reporting we do is, this person lost all this money and here's how to fight it, and what the scammers are doing. But in this case, I wanted to do a deep dive with one victim who lost all of her retirement money, like close to $600,000, to a government imposter scam. And this person impersonated a real FBI agent who I was able to contact, and he was very open in talking to me about what that feels like, that your career, your resume is used to scam, a Maryland woman out of all her retirement money. And part of the series was to get people from stop victim blaming. Financial crimes are probably one of the few crimes that people feel it's okay to say, well, how could they be so stupid? How could they fall for that? How could they not see that? Well, when you read this series, you'll see how. These scammers are very sophisticated. They have spent their time honing this craft of manipulating people, getting them into an ether. And so I talk about that, and it's like a seven-part, it's almost like a serial. So seven parts, every part I introduce you to a different aspect of the scam, the victim, the criminal, how do they do this, the government of folks whose identity was stolen. And then finally, the support groups that have had to be created to help fraud victims. And so, you know, if you are listening and you think you are too smart to be scammed, you're not. And the other thing is, we need to stop saying, well, how did you give them their money? She didn't give them their money. It was stolen. You know, how could you not do this? We need to not do that. We need to embrace these victims. What happened? I'm so sorry this happened to you. Do you want to tell me about it? And give them a space to come forward, because the more people who come forward, it will help the authorities investigate them and put it out there, because this is an epidemic. This is a crisis in America that is not getting enough notice, particularly from the legislative branches of the government.
And I will note that if somebody from Maine's Attorney General office is listening, I'm sure they are saying hallelujah right now. This is a place you can call here in Maine to report that. And also, just your local law enforcement, your local police department is a place to call as well, correct?
That's right. That's right. I'm sorry, Jen. People will report it and they think that maybe an investigator will report their case. That's not always the case. But it does help them see the patterns and perhaps find other victims. And that's how they end up getting cases against these scammers.
All right. Let's see. Before we go to calls and emails, I just want to ask you a couple really practical questions. And the first is, we started talking a little philosophically about maybe trying to figure out what the root of your financial issues are. But practically speaking, what should we all be doing every year? I mean, we know to get our oil changed in our car. What about for financial safety? What do you recommend that folks kind of do regularly?
I love that. I'm not trying to comment about that, Jen. That's a great idea. You should use your finances just like you get the regular oil changes on your car. So at the beginning of the year, you want to do a couple of things. First things, if you're saving for retirement, you want to look at your retirement accounts. And when I say look at it, just don't look at the number. Where's your money invested? How did it do for the year? Do you need to change how you're investing? Maybe you are too much in equities when you really wanted to be, you know, a little bit more in bonds. So it's just really look at what, because when I ask the average person, they tell me they've got a 401k. I say, oh, so what are you investing in? They don't know a clue. They don't really even know how the 401k, you know, works. And that's okay, because this stuff is very complicated. But look at your portfolio. Look and see where you're investing, and make sure that you're on track for that. Maybe you need to up your contributions. And then look at if you got debt, look at all the debt. And I mean all of it, not just the credit card debt, even your mortgage. Because people will say, I say, oh, you have any debt? And they go, I don't have any debt except for my mortgage. Well, last time I checked, that was debt. You know? So don't think of debt in different pots. Like, I'm not one of these people that says there's good debt and bad debt. There is just debt. Look at all of it, embrace it, and figure out if you have a plan, if you need to pay it off. For example, my husband and I paid off our home. We are home. We are completely debt-free. He retired about a year and a half ago, and one of our goals was that we would pay off our home before either one of us retired. So that's the other thing. You want to do some goal setting. And goal setting helps you keep those promises that you make when you make those resolutions. We have 3 children that we put through college with no loans. And that was one of our resolutions, to get our kids to school. And so whenever there was a temptation to overspend, we would go back and look at those goals. So you want to look at your retirement, look at your debt load, and then, you know, have a plan. Just like with your car, you know, you got to get an oil change. You got to make sure the tire's okay. You know, if you need to rotate them, you should have a schedule for your money, just like you would in caring for your home or your car or anything that you want to maintain and keep the value.
Do you recommend people check their credit score?
Oh, absolutely. I'm sorry. I did forget that, too. check your credit score. And if you've got a credit card or a bank account, you can get access to your credit score through one of those institutions. So just look at it. If it's not where you want it to be, you know, look at and all of them have some sort of tools associated with that score to show you how you can improve your score. You want to pull your credit reports, which is different from your credit score. And in fact, all 3 credit bureaus will allow you to pull your credit report once a week. Now, the law says every 12 months, but after the pandemic, they opened that up. So now you can pull your credit report weekly from all 3 credit bureaus, and you should do that.
And before I move on to calls, Also, I'm going to guess that you recommend people look really closely at things like your checking account, online statement, and your credit card statements, and make sure you recognize all those charges. Speaking of scams.
That's right. That's right. Because they sneak things in. One of the ways scammers figure out whether they can use a credit card is they will make small charges, things that you might not notice, like $1 or $2 or $10. And then if it goes through and you don't notice it, then they like flood the car. I have alerts on every account that I have, every bank account, every credit card. My phone is dinging all day long, you know, because a lot of it's bill paying. So it'll say, oh, you paid a bill. Da, da, da. It drives my husband crazy because he'll spend like $8 and I'm on the phone with him like, did you spend $8? He's like, woman, why are you calling me about $8? And I said, because it could be a scammer. But you do, because and then sometimes it's a legitimate company that is just overcharging. For example, my husband likes to get his car done at a car wash. It changed management. So it stopped. It shut down. And they were still dinging us for that monthly charge. And because, you know, I'm looking, I'm thinking, honey, didn't you say they closed down for a while? And so we had to get our money back. Man, had we not been carefully watching that, they would have dinged us for a couple of months when we weren't getting services because we were so used to that charge. We didn't kind of, you know, we might not have paid attention. So you're absolutely right. When you get those statements, either electronically or through the mail, I get highlighters. I have a whole bunch of highlighters on my desk and just highlight things and just make sure make sure they're charging you the right amount. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've called and like, this is not what I agreed to. You got to go back and give me my money back.
You know? Good for you.
Yeah, you got to be on alert with this stuff.
I have alerts as well, Michelle. I know what you're talking about. we're going to go to Gail calling from Sanford. Hi, Gail, go ahead.
Hi, I'm going to be selling my house soon, and I am retired, and so I need to put the money into something safe that can draw some interest. What would you recommend? I know there are money markets and bonds and things. Which would be the best, and what kind of interest could I expect?
Well, you still have high yield savings accounts right now, paying anywhere from 3% to 4%. So you would check your current institution, see what they're offering, or if you feel a little comfortable with it. Most of the high yield accounts are online banks. They don't have brick and mortar offices. Make sure that it's FDIC insured. If you're using a credit union, they also have a federal agency that provides insurance. So make sure that they are insured. And then just park the money there. If you're going to be using the money to maybe buy another home or, you're going to need it in 5 years, you don't want to invest it, right? Because you want to keep it safe. But it certainly is safe to put it in a high yield account earning. And right now, because the Fed has been bringing rates down, you're going to be looking at between 3% and 4%.
There you go, Michelle. Thanks for calling in. We'll go up to Brownfield and Vinny. Hi, Vinny. Go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering on the Treasury inflation protected securities. When's a good time to buy them in the economy? And is it better to buy the long-term 10-year or the 5-year term? And it is a good thing to put in a portfolio.
So, you know, I get questions like this all the time, and it would be easy for me to tell you what to do, but I really, when you're asking these type of questions, you should have an overall plan on how you're investing your money. So, you know, treasuries, short term, you know, what kind of rate you want, are you going to need access to that money, you know, bonds, stocks. So I would suggest when people are asking these questions to sit down and really sit down with a financial planner and say, okay, what part of my money might I want in treasuries? What part of my money do I want in equities? What part do I want in bonds? What part do I want in cash equivalents? So it's in a bank account. And I can't tell you where any rates are going. And if I could, trust me, as much as I love this program and Jen, I would be on an island in the Caribbean if I knew where rates were going, because I would just be sitting really pretty on a big pile of money. So, but we do know that things are going to be a little interesting this year in terms of rates. We know mortgage rates might come down a little bit. Savings rates have come down. You know, those 5% offers probably are not going to be out there anymore. You're going to look at more to 3-4%. And treasuries move with Fed, so I can't really tell you where it's going to be. I don't, you know, if there's tariffs coming down the road. I mean, it's going to be an interesting year this year. So I would just say keep watch on your money and have a plan so you're not knee-jerking any decisions. So if, like, the stock market crashed, not crash, it probably won't do that, but if it comes down, you're not like, oh, I got to get out of stocks and go to treasuries, right? You need an overall plan for your money.
All right. Well, Vinny, thank you so much for your question. We have so many coming in. This is from Tom. Michelle, this is a little longer than the emails I like to read, but I will read it. Please, nobody else send one this long. Should my wife and I consider downsizing? My wife and I are in our early 60s. We own a home that's larger than we need, but we enjoy being able to have our adult children home. We are currently able to afford to maintain it, and we expect to be able to continue to do so in retirement if we can wait till we're 70 to do that. We owe about $155,000, and we've owned it for 20 years. We've refinanced over time, and our current interest rate is 3.13%. The house is worth about $400,000. We're currently paying off a rooftop solar array and Parent Plus loans. Those should both be paid off before we retire. Between our current expenses, current home prices, interest rates, and our lifestyle, it doesn't seem to make sense to downsize. Are we missing something?
I would say no. I love the way he laid out the emails. So they have carefully thought through all of this, and they've done exactly, Tom has done exactly what I would have recommended. Look at what's right for you for right now. Don't hear, because a lot of times people will say, oh, you know, you're single, you should downsize. And my husband and I are in that same situation. I know if you see a picture of me, I look like I'm 29, but I am not. You know, we're in our early 60s. And we have a larger house because we had a larger family. And we thought about that too. But to buy this house or even downsize, we would get less house for more money. We paid off our mortgage, but we had the cash to do that. And so we decided that we're going to stay for right now. Just like Tom, we have a large family. The big holidays are usually at our house. We have always opened our door to people who may be experiencing financial challenges to come live with us so they can get their life together. So we like having that room and that ability to take in someone if they need to be. So we are okay. So if it works for you right now and you have worked the numbers, which you clearly have, then you have made the best decision for yourself. And that is the key. I teach people this decision tree that you walk through steps. What is the decision you have to make? What are your non-negotiables? How much does it cost? Have you looked at all the alternatives? And it looked like they have done that. And if you have done that, you should be comfortable in the decision that you make. And guess what? If at any point it's not right for you, guess what? You can make a different decision and downsize at that point. And so I would say you've done what you're supposed to do, and you should be, and I don't think you are missing anything.
Wonderful. An email from Allison. Please discuss a strategy for protecting a lifetime of hard-earned assets from draining away in old age to nursing home expenses or similar circumstance. Big question.
That's a big question. I don't know that there is a way to protect your funds from the thing that in life happens. Lots of us will end up having to have long-term care, and you save for just that. And so when the time comes to use that money, use that money. And I say that from experience. My father-in-law had spent his whole life saving and then had some health crisis towards the end of his life. And it took almost an act of God to get him to spend money on a home health aide to take care of her. Oh, I can't do that. And it was like, you know, Dad, this is exactly why you saved. We need help. I need help because I end up being, because I work from home, one, you know, primary caregiver, and I'm working. So we hired someone who came in the morning, and then we hired someone who came in the evening to help with us, and using that money that he saved, that really is going to be one of your biggest expenses in your senior years, long-term care. Some people might have long-term care insurance to supplement that. But I would say in terms of protecting it from the use of it, I don't know if that is how you should look at it. You should look at it if you have the money to take care of you, and it will help you, and it will help your caregivers to help you, then use that money that you saved for at a time in your life when you need assistance.
We'll go to Loli, who's calling from Brunswick. Hi, Loli. Go ahead.
Yes. I don't know what they're called, but there's apps on the phone where you can track your expenses and they can help you get rid of old charges or something. Are those real, or should we be really skeptical about those?
There are apps that will help look at, because what you do is you import your information from your credit cards or your bank accounts, and it can kind of keep track of your subscriptions and things like that. Because lots of times people subscribe to things and they forget about it and they keep getting charges and they're not paying attention. And so if you are not that, you know, careful about looking at yourself, they can be useful. I don't like to spend money, so I'm checking my own stuff, you know. But I do think that they are legitimate. There's some legitimate. Now you've got to do your due diligence to make sure. Actually, you really, your local, if you have a bank account or a credit union account, they have apps on their websites that sort of help you do that to alert you to things. Me personally, I like for you to put your own eyeballs on your own stuff, so that you see what's going on. You know what's being charged. And the way to do that is just pull your bank accounts, pull your credit card statements, and look at them every month and highlight them. And then you can see what's going on. But yes, there are apps there, you know, that are legitimate that you can use to help that. And if you are a person that's like, I am not a Michelle, I am not going to do that, then yeah, it can be useful for you.
Loli, thanks so much for calling in with that question. I know a lot of people have that. We are talking with Michelle Singletary, personal finance columnist and author. Your questions, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Answers to Your Personal Finance Questions. And joining me, Michelle Singletary. Her column first runs in the Washington Post and then is syndicated to more than 100 other papers. Share your comments and questions. Email us at talk@mainepublic.org. You can also find us on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Michelle, so many questions coming in. I'm going to try to choose those that may apply to the most people. An email here from Debbie. I've been seeing ads for an app that allows people to get up to $500 of their paycheck early. They say, download this app and get your money when you want it. This can't be a good idea, is it?
No, because you got to pay for that, right? A lot of sort of pay, I forget what they call it, it is a term for it, where, and really it's set up for people who are having, or, you know, oftentimes struggling making it from paycheck to paycheck, but you're going to pay for that. And if you're in that situation and you need to get your pay in advance, and there's probably something else going on, I would recommend that you seek help with a nonprofit credit counselor who can help you with budgeting and try to figure out what's going on. The payday loans, that's what I was sort of thinking of, is sort of payday loans. So they, in the interest rates, when you look at them on an annualized basis, because they'll go, oh, it's like $30 or $40. But when you translate it into an interest rate, we're talking like 300% or something to that extent. And so I would not want you to do that. I mean, and I know that it can be very stressful for a lot of people, but it may mean that you have something else that you need to do, like perhaps your housing is too expensive.
An email from Steph. If I have extra money and already have enough of a security reserve, is it better to put any extra money on my house to reduce what I owe on it, or into invest money in the market, something conservative? My mortgage interest rate is 6.125%. I currently save 15% of my income to retirement as well. So good question. What's better, paying off your mortgage or putting more into your retirement fund?
I think you should do both. Sorry, I had a little coughing spell. I should apologize for that. So when I look at how to pay off debt, I want to prioritize things. So I know I said I paid off my mortgage early, but I didn't make that a priority over saving for the kids' college fund or building an emergency fund. So you want to look at the priority of what you're going to have to do. And so if you want to pay off your mortgage and get rid of debt and save and invest, sort of look at it in a tier sort of situation. So starting out in the beginning of our careers and our kids, we prioritize saving for college. We prioritize having an emergency fund. And the mortgage wasn't as important. So we just made our regular mortgage payments. And when we could make principal payments, we did. As we ended up saving enough for the kids, or one of our kids got a scholarship, then we reprioritized our plan and we put more money in paying off our mortgage early, but also while saving for retirement. So it's not an either or kind of situation. If you're in the position to try to do it all, You just prioritize. And that's, I think, the best way to not freak yourself out because you're like, oh, this stuff is happening. I got to save for retirement. I want to pay off my house. I want to do. So you want to have a plan for yourself. And it's going to be a plan in different seasons of your life. So early on, prioritize the children, saving for college, and as much as we could put in retirement plan. We didn't max out because we didn't have all that kind of money. As the kids got older, we had enough in their retirement plan. We switched. We started to max out our retirement plans. Now we're closer to getting retirement, so now we're looking at our expenses. We're trying to make sure we've got money saved so that if for any period of time the market kind of gets a little wonky, we don't have to pull money out. And one of the reasons why we paid off our mortgage early is that because we wanted to have a better cash flow and we didn't want to give the bank any more money. And we gave up a really low interest rate, and people lost their mind when I wrote about that. But in the end, it worked out because that meant my husband did not have to touch his retirement account. And over the last year, the S&P 500 was like, yay, like 23%. So imagine if we had to pull money out to pay that mortgage. So now we made out better, even though we took money out to pay off the mortgage. And so we didn't pay interest. And most Americans, they talk about the mortgage interest deduction. You're not even doing it because you don't itemize. So that's a non-starter. And so you can, I hope what you're hearing from me is that there's no one fix for everybody, but you need to have a series of priorities throughout your life, depending on the season of life that you're in.
A question from Paul. My parents are in their 90s and have been able to use long-term care insurance to help pay for full-time caregivers, but the long-term care funds will run out at some point. What do you think of using a reverse mortgage on their house, which is paid off, as a source of income for their care? They both have longevity in their families, so they still may have many years of caregiving costs ahead.
So that's a whole conversation about reverse mortgages. I think in this situation, a reverse mortgage might work. Please look at it very carefully. There tend to be a little higher fees for it, but the way a reverse mortgage is that it's opposite of the traditional mortgage. So traditional mortgage, you have a monthly payment. With a reverse mortgage, you don't pay anything until the person passes away or they move out of the home or they sell. And so that gives people, particularly for those who are what we call house rich, cash poor. And so I think for this particular individual situation, a reverse mortgage might work because if they've got a lot of money tied up in their house and, in their 90s, and we hope they live a long life, but we know, the average person, even if they reach to 100, not much past that. So you can use that money from the house to take care of them. And that's a good use of that money in the house.
We'll go to Susan calling from Appleton. Hi, Susan, go ahead.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for taking the call. Listen, okay, so the backstory is that I have or had a Roth IRA that I was paying into 2008. It lost like a third of its value in like no time. And I was young enough and working, so I just let it ride, But now I'm not that young anymore, and I can't afford to lose the money. So since it's a Roth IRA and I don't have to pay income tax on the deposits that I made, I pulled all the money out because I'm really worried about this incoming administration and the chaos and the finance and you get the picture. So it's now sitting, not a huge amount of money, but it's sitting in my bank account. And I don't, I'm not interested in making money, I'm interested in not losing money. And so I'm thinking, and my house is paid off. I don't owe any mortgage. I'm off grid. I don't pay utilities. I live a very, very inexpensive life, but I do not have an income particularly high because I have another IRA that I'm paying off, that I'm receiving money in Social Security. But I can't afford to lose what I have. So that's why I took it out. Should I be putting it in bonds? Should I be putting it in CDs, money markets, that kind of stuff. What's the
Susan,
safest
how old
place?
are you? Real quick, how old are you?
72.
72. Okay. So you sound real young. I'd say I would have guessed more like 50. So, Susan, you're a great candidate to, and you, I hope you don't push back on this, to meet with a financial planner and look at everything and see what's right for you. I did cringe a little about when you got scared and you pulled all that money out, because at 72, if you are healthy and you're doing well, you could live another 30 years. And so you said you don't want to lose money, and you said that a couple of times. But if you don't have your money in an instrument that at least keeps pace with inflation, you are losing money. So that would be the equivalent of taking all that money and putting it in a mattress under your bed. And it's like, I'm not going to lose money, but you are. You're losing the buying power of that money. So if you live another 20 or 30 years, your money has to buy what you need, but prices go up, right, with inflation. And so you might look at a place to park that money that is going to at least help you keep pace with inflation. A high yield account at 2, 3, or 4% will do that right now since inflation has come down. But what if inflation goes up again to 4 or 5%, and it was, 9% or so, what, in 2021? So you want to look at inflation, particularly for this pot of money. And if people are listening, you did the right thing in 2008 and not panicking if you got time on your hand. And I know people close to retirement in retirement say, well, I don't have time, but you actually do. And you don't need to pull all the money out, because you're not going to use all the money at one time. So even if you need to pull out some to cover you while you wait for the market to recover to pay for things, that's what you would do instead of pulling all that one. So when people say they lost money, especially during the Great Recession, you lost because you locked in those losses by taking the money out. If you stay patient, like you did initially, it recovered and then it grew. And so I would say sit down with someone, look at everything, look at what you're getting for. If you got a pension, I heard you say you're pulling money from IRA, Social Security, and then that will tell you how to invest that money if you need to invest it and what to invest it in. Maybe for you, putting that money in bonds, it would work, or a combination of equities and bonds. But you need an overall plan so that you, again, remember earlier in the program, I said you don't want to have knee-jerk reactions to things that happen in the market. And I know a lot of people are, concerned about the administration, as I am. But you know what? This too will pass. And so we've been through a whole lot of craziness in this country. And if you're an African American, a whole lot more. And I'm just being real, right? Like, we were at a time where I wasn't considered a regular person, right? In my lifetime, it's only in my lifetime that I had the right to vote. And I have to remember that as bad as we think things are, there were times that was worse. And so, but you still don't want to do anything with your money that is short term when it's not going to be a short term problem. Right? Saving for retirement is long term, even when you're in your 70s.
Michelle, I think a lot of people are nervous when they hear you recommend a financial planner. They think, how do I find someone I can trust? What is your advice about finding someone you can trust? Do you advise a fee-only financial planner, or what route, or will our local bank perhaps have a recommendation?
All of what you just said, that's right. Start with someone that you know. If someone you know is working with a financial planner, start with that person. Who do you work with, if your friends are talking about that, and make an appointment with that person and listen to them. My company actually provides financial planning, and so we have access to a planner to look over our portfolio. Or you could start with whatever financial company you're working with. If you've got money in Vanguard or Fidelity, all of them have platforms in which you can hire someone to look at that. And then you just look online for fee only, the organizations that will help put you in contact with them. And then interview at least three people, and make sure that they're listening to you. And the other thing is, you want to look for someone who possibly has what we call fiduciary responsibility, meaning that they have to recommend things that are in your best interest. But I don't want people to be afraid of meeting with someone. If you do your due diligence, financial planners can help you a great deal. It's like, if I've got a bad toothache, or I've got some abscess on my tooth, I'm not going to try to pull it out myself. I'm going to go to a dentist. It's the same thing with your money. And it sounds counterintuitive to pay someone to help you with the money when you're trying to save money. But they have the ability to have you sit down and look at the overall picture of something. That's why I'm very hesitant when people say, well, where should I put my money? Should I buy the stock? But you got to look at everything so that you know all that was going on. And I have to tell you, it was a financial planner that put my husband on the my husband and I on the path to wealth. And I was scared of the stock markets when we first met, you know, many, many moons ago. And she said to me, Michelle, the same thing I've been saying to you, you got to pay attention to inflation. You can't be scared of the stock market. You should be saving for your kids' college fund. And she laid out a plan. And the plan she gave us was like a half inch thick, lots of pages, lots of numbers. And my husband and I followed everything in that plan. And we are doing well today because of that planner. As much as I know, I didn't know enough. And also the psychology of things. I'm coming from, you know, my grandmother didn't invest in anything, not even bonds. All she had was the bond adhesive for her dentures. So I'm coming from a background where nobody knew anything about the stock market. And she was able to help walk me through the blocks that I had. And I'm very grateful to that financial planner. So don't be scared to hire one. Just make sure you check them out. You check their credentials. And if they're asking you to invest in something that's a little wonky, or they say things like, oh, you know, you, this is high return, low risk. If they say something like that, run, run, run. But if you do your due diligence, you can find a plan that will help you. And help a lot, help you through some of the fears that you might have about your money and the market.
Susan, thanks for your question. I'm sure you're not alone. We'll go to an email here from Elizabeth. How do you recommend people who are considering buying a home, moving on from renting, to figure out how much to budget for maintenance and repairs? It seems like it'd be important to consider that amount along with expected mortgage payment and utilities, but I've never seen a good guidance on how to budget for this. So there we go. Great question.
Great question.
I can tell you my husband and I didn't budget for it. We barely afforded our first house. How do you get your head around this?
That's such a great question. So first of all, let's start with, and I know for a lot of people, this is going to be really difficult because we, you know, you live in a high cost area, but the first place is how much you pay for your mortgage and, you know, the insurance and taxes. So we recommend, you know, rent about, you know, 30% of your net pay. Now I know that's crazy in a lot of areas. So if it's going to be more than that, we're approaching 40%, that means it's a little tougher for you to save for stuff. So start there. In terms of maintenance, you look at the age of the house and what has to happen. So if you're buying an older house, you know it's going to be some something. So before you buy, you look at how much longer do I have on the roof? And then you get some quotes on how much it costs to replace the roof. That's how you, so if you know you've got 5 years to that roof, then you're going to have a 5-year saving plan to replace that roof. If you move into an old house and it's got a heater that is on its last leg, then you build that into your budget. So you got, I got 2 years. So you're going to have a budget that allows you to save for that 2 years. If it's a newer home, the costs are more going to be like, you know, you want a couch, you want to, you know, buy stuff for it. So you have to look at the age of the house, what you might want to put in the house, and then you budget based on how long you have until you have to make that improvement. My two daughters in their 20s just bought their house, and we set them down and did everything I just told you about. The bank qualified them for a higher amount. Mommy and daddy qualified them for a lower amount. And they went with a lower amount. So we said you should not spend more than 30% of your take-home pay for each of them for this mortgage payment. And they stayed within that. So they looked at houses less than what the bank said. And then we said you are not, because they were living with us to save money. So you're not going to move until you have a certain amount of money in the bank. So they have a certain amount of money in the bank. And they opened up a joint account. They're putting money into it every month, not just for their mortgage, but for maintenance, for the things in the house, you know, because they now have to do some stuff with the roof. They want to do something with the yard. So they have a plan to save for that. And they're doing it slow by slow, not all at once. And this is the things that we taught them. So you can budget for this just like you budget for everything else.
We'll go to Janet, who's calling from Paris, Maine. And Janet, we're short on time. So if you could ask your question quickly, that would be great.
Okay, thanks. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
Just heard you on Meghna's show last week, I think. I have a grandson who's making fabulous money, still living at home, has a Roth IRA. What other investment tools should he get into, or should he just see a financial planner?
Well, I would say he could meet with a financial planner, but that sounds like you had a great grandson. He sounds like he's doing, you know, especially living at home and saving the money. I would say, when my girls and my son is at home as well, we told them to save almost all of their pay, you know, upwards of 80% and put that away. And then, you know, also invest for retirement. So just make sure he's got a cash cushion. Roth is great if you're a young adult. Make sure, you know, ask him if he's got a workplace retirement plan. It sounds like he probably does. And he's putting money in that. And now if he's living at home, he should reach that 15% that's recommended by Fidelity Investments, recommends that you put in 15% of your gross pay in your retirement account. And that would include whatever match. So ask him, hey, baby, you know, how much are you putting in your retirement account? Are you meeting that 15%? And that's a good way to see if he's on track. But I bet he is.
Yeah. And the amount of money, the way it can grow if you put it in when you're in your 20s is just remarkable, isn't it?
It's remarkable. And if he doesn't have rent and he's not the full cost of living out on your own, he's got all that money that he can now build up and get a head start. And he could be a millionaire by the time he retires.
Janet, thanks for your call. And thank you, Michelle, Washington Post personal finance columnist, author of 4 personal finance books, including What to Do with Your Money When a Crisis Hits, a survival guide. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Main Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, our 11 a.m. program will be preempted by NPR coverage of President Jimmy Carter's funeral. At 8 p.m., we will listen back to our earlier program on winter farmers markets. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Main Calling on Maine Public Radio.